So we worked pretty hard in the last 90 minutes, and that was the most complicated measurement. And I really went into the gory detail of it all because I wanted you to get really the perspective of why some of these measurements sometimes take 6 or 7 years to make, even though the data, so the data that it's based on was actually taken more than 10, 12 years ago. It's just because the devil is in the detail for a lot of these measurements. And when you have that many events, I mean, you saw some of these plots where you had tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of events in one bin. If you want to do justice to the statistical precision, you really need to do the work on the systematics. So I just want to just say a few words about multiple boson production. We spent a lot of run ones. When I say run one, I mean from 2010 to about 2013. Kind of discovering these channels in the sense that these are quite heavy final states. You have either two W's or two Z's in the final state. And so in order to do interesting things with them, it took us a while to collect enough statistics because the production cross-sections for these are quite low. But so you want to measure them because, you know, they're there. But really what you also want to measure them for is to see if there's anything anomalous in particular when it comes into the coupling of the gauge bosons. So I'm going to go through that a little bit just to give you an overview of where we stand in terms of things that go into 2Z bosons in the final state. This is a ratio of what you measure with what your expectation is. This is a CMS, so I do include a few CMS plots here. So these are all independent measurements. If you see two times or three times a Z, it's probably different production mechanisms or different final states of the Z. But the bottom line is, goodness, the measurements agree well with the standard model. So I want to just work through. I took a few illustrative cases because I want to make a few points here on some of the measurements. So here, this is how you go about measuring the fiducial cross-section of something that produces a W and a Z in a final state. If you can at all, if you can devise measurements that are ratios, life is really good. Look at this ratio. This is a ratio, the production of a W plus plus Z to a W minus plus Z. What's great about this ratio? Any systematic uncertainties will basically cancel. Because whatever uncertainties you have on the W here, you'll have the same uncertainties at the bottom. They're correlated. Whatever you had up here for the Z will cancel here. And so basically, whenever you can make cross-sections, ratios of things that have final states that cancel very easily, you're just left almost with just the statistical uncertainty. So even in our very, very first measurement, the very first W and Z cross-section we made in 2010, it was a crappy little measurement because we hardly had any statistics, but we did take a W plus over W minus ratio, and with a very first measurement, we had a precision of about 2% on almost no data. So we were really just, you can get rid of systematics. So this is a great example here. This is, like I said, WZ, ratio of W plus to W minus. In red are the statistical uncertainties, and in blue, which you can barely see, this is what's the tiny residual systematic that you might have that doesn't quite cancel out in the numerator and the denominator. You might have some cases where it doesn't quite cancel out because maybe the backgrounds are not entirely the same. The kinematics of a W plus is not quite the same as the kinematics of a W minus. So you don't get 100% cancellation, but gosh, you get rid of a lot of uncertainties. And ratios like this are actually sensitive to PDFs. So this is another measurement that you can use to test part-time distribution functions. And WZ final states are nice because they have the best of both worlds. If you were to look for a final state with a W and another W, big cross-section, but you're missing a neutrino coming from here, you're missing a neutrino coming from here. So you have lots of sources of background. A lot of things can look like two leptons in the final state. If you want to be super clean, you would say, oh, I just want to look at final states with two Zs. These are fully reconstructed. But the production cross-section for W versus a Z, this is 10 times smaller. So this rate is really tiny compared to this rate. So the juste milieu, you know, the perfect, you know, Goldilocks, you know, my porridge is too hot, my porridge is too cold, my porridge is just right, is a W and Z, because you have one which has a nice high production cross-section, and you still have that Z to be able to help you nail down the systematics. So this is a measurement from CMS of WZ in the final state. This is a measurement of two Zs in the final state, so ZZ final state, and each of these Zs goes to two leptons, so you're looking for four leptons. So such a measurement is very much statistics limited, as I said, because the cross-section for Z is low, and then the cross-section for 2 times Z is even lower. And you can see it in a plot like this one. This is the relative uncertainty of a measurement like that. In blue is the total uncertainty as a function of which PT you're at. Blue is the total. Dashed is the data statistical uncertainty. And you can see that pretty much everywhere except in the very first bin here. So basically at PT is almost zero. Everywhere else, it's totally statistics dominated. You can almost forget the systematic. And it's only really when you get to the very low PT that you can start worrying a little bit about contributions being almost comparable between theory and experiment. So that also tells you where, if you want to do a nice thesis maybe in phenomenology and you want to do something that's going to really improve my life, you can go and try to tell me what the production cross-section is expected to be right very close to PT is equal to zero, because that is still a dominant uncertainty in that bin. And over here, you can see how the ZZ cross-section changes as a function of the center of mass energy. So over here at 2 TeV, these are the results coming from Tevatron. 7 TeV was the first measurements at the LHC at 7 TeV. Second measurements of the LHC here at 8 TeV, these are these points here, and these are the more recent measurements at 13 TeV, and you can see that the cross-section is going up. You have more energy, so I guess you can produce more of them. So those were for the production of two bosons in the final state. Once you have enough of them that you can actually say, hey, I actually see this signature, the next thing you want to do after that is you want to go and probe this vertex here. Is this vertex here, so the vertex of three bosons, is it a standard model vertex? Or could it be other stuff? Could there be new physics that's happening in this vertex here? So I did this little diagram here of basically almost every combination of three bosons that you can do. Maybe the only one I don't have here is gamma, gamma, gamma. So in the standard model, two of these actually have non-zero value that are, you know, you expect to have a value there in the standard model. So the way that I've tried to, well, I haven't, this is the formalism, to probe this coupling, wherever you see a delta, these are the ones where you expect a value from the standard model at leading order, at tree level. So what we do there is we're probing delta, which is one, it's the deviation from what the standard model value should be. And for all the other ones, these are the ones that at tree level should be zero. When you go to higher orders, you might get something that's not zero, but it should be fairly close to zero. So basically, you're probing all quantities that in the standard model should basically be zero, and only if you go beyond the standard model you would expect to have something that is non-zero in all of these. So they're kind of two different formalisms. The first one was very popular at the beginning, especially during run one. I think this kind of formalism here is becoming more popular now. So the first one is you would build an effective Lagrangian. All right. And as I mentioned, you have couplings that are zero or deviations from the standard model, so delta. The terms of the Lagrangian would lead to unitarity violation versus root s. unless there's some kind of new physics that kicks in at some scale. And so the form factor parameterization is given here, and every time I make a little I out of this and I save it, it goes to a capital I. I don't know why. This is really annoying. And I swear this morning I fixed it again. So it's one of those weird bugs. So lambda is basically the scale, whatever it may be, where the new physics would kick in that would give you that. There's also an effective field theory approach. I'll mention that a little bit more when I go in a moment in quartic couplings rather than these three boson couplings right here. All right, I'm just going to give you one example of how you would go about this experimentally. So you pick a variable. So this is WZ again. Huh? This is the production of WZ at 8 and at 13 TV. So you pick a variable in your analysis that would be sensitive to distortions, to changes in this point here. So here we're talking about WZ, so we're talking about this bubble here. So an example of this is the transverse spans of the WZ system. Here it is. The colored histograms, these are all the standard model expectations. The white one being the signal that you're looking for, and you can see the signal that you're looking for is not huge. I mean, we can see it clearly, but it's not an enormous signal. The colored ones are the background, and of course there's the ratio between the two. And then we have dashed lines here. These are just for the fun of it. These dashed lines, and this is where I can use my fancy pointer. Make it worth my while. Look at that. Isn't that cool? Isn't it worth $100? look here. So these dashed lines are what this variable would look like if there were these non-standard model values for these three couplings, right? There's three couplings here. There's lambda z, and then the deviations from the standard model values for kappa z and g1z. And if that were the case, if you had these deviations, you would have these kinds of distortions. So obviously these are gross distortions from what you expect, but it's just to prove the point that this variable is sensitive to distortions coming from a coupling. So that's what you would do. You would have, first of all, you would identify this process. You'd try and find as many particles as you can coming from this process. You would identify a variable that is sensitive. If you're lucky, maybe you have multiple variables that are sensitive and you can fit multiple variables at the same time. And then you find your favorite model, your favorite Monte Carlo, that hopefully describes fairly well the standard model processes. And then you can use that model and just reweight it. What would it look like if, you know, you had delta GZ of 0.1, or if the lambda Z were 0.1? So you basically reweight to various hypotheses, and then you compare the data to your various hypotheses. Now, even without the hypotheses, you can see that the data agrees very well the standard model to start off with. But if it didn't, well, you'd be lucky. And then, so you have three possible things that you're probing here, right, in this bubble here. So how would you go about doing it? Well, there's few ways to do it, because it's hard to extract information from three things. What you can do is you can say, okay, let me assume that only one of them might be deviant from the standard model, and I'll assume the others are not. So basically, this is the limits you would extract for this one, assuming the other two are zero. And similarly, you do that for each of these. So basically, you set limits on each coupling, assuming the other ones are zero. Another way that you can do it in two dimensions is you can assume pairs. So it's basically you're looking at pairs, assuming that the third one is zero. And I guess if you go in three dimensions, you could probably do all three. But of course, every time you do that, you're removing one constraint, which means your limits become less and less stringent. So that's how you would go about trying to measure this. And standard model in this is always zero, and you can see the standard model has always rules. Then you can go to quartic. So basically, you produce three bosons in the final state. with another boson here in the propagator. So these are all, well, not all the combinations, but the most of the combinations that are interesting to us. These ones are allowed in the standard model. The ones over here are not allowed in the standard model. Maybe through higher orders, there might be some small contributions coming from diagrams that are not quite this one. But now in this situation, what is being used nowadays mostly is you expand the standard model Lagrangian with operators, a dimension of at least 4, suppressed by the energy scale of this new physics. And you can see that lambda again here. And then over here, you have the coefficients. So then you get these dimensionless coefficients out of them called Wilson coefficients. There are lots of them. There are some that are associated with the Higgs field, some associated with field strength of these guys here, and some with both. And there's so many of them, and there's so many final states that I remember when I was looking into this, I was going, oh, I can't keep them track of all of them. And then I found this magical paper. I just want to share this magical paper with you. Should you ever want to do this, isn't that beautiful? It tells you for every single quartic combination which one of these coefficients are meaningful. All right. So this is a nice plot to have. Now, we have a big problem with this because producing 3 bosons in the final state is a very heavy final state, and we just barely can say that we actually observe 3 bosons in the final state, just barely. Let me show you here what we did at ATV. So at ATV, we hadn't actually observed 3 Ws in the final state. So we look at 3 Ws in the final state. We can look at different categories. We can assume, say, each of the 3 Ws decays leptonically, which is very, well, it's pretty clean, but wow, the cross-section for that is very low. You can say, okay, 2 of them will decay leptonically, and a 3rd one will decay into jets. And so you try to make a data sample based on these requirements. And then you use a Monte Carlo like you did before. You look for a sensitive variable. In this case, the sensitive variable is the transverse mass for the 3 leptons. So this is for this category up here. Here's the plot. If you were to look very quickly in the plot, you'd say, well, that's not too bad. You have what, 4, 10, you've got 18, you've got about 20 events there. That's not bad. Except pink is background. Pink is not tri-W. Yellow is tri-W. So really what you're doing is you're measuring the quartic coupling of background events, something like that. So you tried to do that your best, okay. You never know. Hey, you never know. Maybe it's not the standard Mal value. Maybe there's new physics. So maybe these couplings are enhanced. So maybe you get lucky and you see a whole bunch of stuff that the standard model tells you doesn't really exist. And then you go through the math. You do exactly like you did before. You know, you build the templates, and you can see here what it would look like if some of these coefficients, just sort of canonical values for these coefficients. You can see what the shape of the distribution would be. These, again, we always kind of do really gross deviations, so you can really see what the range would be. We don't see it. You know, here again is, sorry, I overwrote it here. Basically, it's this one versus this one. So these are the 2. There's the standard model value. This is the exclusion. Now, it's only just very recently at 13 TV that we can finally say we observe 3 Ws in the final state. So you know in particle physics, it's the 5 sigma criteria. If you don't see it at least at 5 standard deviations of significance, you can't claim it. This one, we see it at 8. So we really do see it. So this is in basically the same idea as what I had here, but it's at 13 TV. So you have more energy, so it's you have more energy to produce them. And here in yellow, you can see here, this is the 3 lepton final state. And then yellow, this is the signal. So you can definitely see the signal. So there's no question that we can see the signal at this point. But OK, I mean, you can play the game here and try to extract the couplings out of it. But of course, it only gets more interesting as we collect more data. So really, I would say that run 1 belonged to the period where we learned a lot about diboson final states, and run two is where the triboson final states are starting to become accessible.
Excuse me?
Yep.
Can you go?
Yep.
I think you were using the term transverse mass before, but
yep.
Not really says on the axis, because before it says transverse momentum. Is there a difference? Or?
So transverse mass, when I talked about these guys, I kind of defined what transverse mass was. Keep going. Almost there. There it is. Basically, meaning you have to do this now for three leptons in the final state. But basically, it's the PT of the lepton with the ET miss, which has a directionality only in the transverse plane, and basically closer to the phi between the two. So you can build a mass value, which is kind of in the transverse plane, related to the transverse momentum and the missing ET of the state. Okay. I spoiled it. I want to first show you a beautiful Venn display. This is a candidate tri-W in the final state. Look at that, tri-W to E-nu, mu-nu. Say that fast 20 times. In blue is the electron. You can see the track. It leaves an inside in the inner tracker. And then you see the energy deposits in the calorimeter. That's one electron here. You don't see it quite as well is the second electron. Here's the other track with the energy it deposits. And then here in blue and red is the muon. And this, you can see it here in the transverse plane, what it looks like. So it's a pretty nice event, huh? It's pretty clean. All right, this is my giraffe. This is the Honolulu Zoo, by the way. Very nice place, Honolulu. All right, there's my top. Okay, so I wanna spend just a little bit of time talking about top quark physics. I don't do much top quark physics. I did a little bit at one point, but it is a beautiful final state because, well, not a final state, it's a beautiful production mechanism with rich final states is what I wanted to say, because there's so much you can learn about the top quark by studying it. So you have your protons producing a TT bar. What can you study in a process like that? Well, first of all, you can measure cross sections. What is the probability for this to happen? And you can there and comparing the standard model, you can see might there be new production mechanisms in here that you don't know about that are not standard model. Now, for each of these top events, you can measure the properties of the top quark, such as the mass, the width, the charge of the top quark. You know, it's the 2/3, but you, as experimentalists, you need to go out and measure that. It's actually pretty hard to measure the charge of the top quark, but it is 2/3. No worries, from as far as I can see. You will have, if you have two top quarks, you can measure things like polarization, spin correlations, sort of things that relate the two. And then the top quark decays basically 100% of the time to a W and a B. And so you can also probe, for example, what this coupling is. Is it really the VTB that you see in your CK matrix element, or maybe there's something anomalous going there? So those are all just examples of different things you can measure just by looking at this. Top quarks were discovered at the Tevatron, sort of 93 or 4, something like that, 1993, 94. And they did a lot with top quarks. The production mechanisms are a little bit inverted between the Tevatron and the LHC just because of the amount of energy that we have. Remember, Tevatron's a 2 TeV. And so at the Tevatron, about 85% of their top quark pairs came from this process here, and 15% came from the other processes over here. Whereas at the LHC, it's inverted. So most comes from this, and only 15% from that. So even though we are both producing top quark pairs, we're actually studying different production mechanisms at the two places. So as I mentioned, the top quark decays 100% of the time, basically, to a W and a B. So then the question is, how does the W decay? And we have, now we know everything about the W. All right, you could have both of your W's decaying leptonically. So that's about 10% of the top pi. You could have both W bosons decaying to jets, which is about 45% of the pi. And then you can have one decaying to leptons and one to jets, which is the other 45% of the pi. Dileptone, very, very clean, but very, very low rates. So you only want to do that if you need a really super clean environment. Lepton bunch jets is, again, you know, the Goldilocks sort of thing. You have a nice lepton, which is easy to identify. You have some jets, so you have a little bit of cross-section. So it's pretty good. So if you measure, for example, the production cross-section for TT bar, you have access to other standard Mall parameters. From that, you can deduce things, of course, like the top mass, but also the fine structure constant. And of course, when you're studying something like this, you can also say, well, maybe there's something other than standard model happening here. Or maybe when you're producing top quarks, maybe you might instead decay to something else, some new heavy quark, some Suzy decays that you don't know about. This is the predictions for the production cross-sections as a function of root S. And this is another place where you can see, so at the Tevatron, it was 7 picobarn. At the LHC, it's about 100 times more. So the LHC really is a top quark factory. Of course, LHC is harder to do because we have more pileups, so it's a dirtier environment, but you know, you make up for it by the fact that you have about a factor of 100. And the uncertainty, the theoretical uncertainties for all of these are about 4 to 5% or so. I wanted to show you this example, not because it's particularly good or you get interesting results out of it. I just want to show you how annoyingly difficult it gets once you start having a lot of things in the final state. So here's a TT bar up here. We're going to have it decay leptonically for the W's, and you have the B quarks. Isn't it nice when you have a nice Feynman diagram? Now imagine I take this and I hide the whole mechanism here, so you can't look at anything. And I say, okay, I want you to measure the top mass. I want you to take the B quark. I want you to take the leptons, and well, you wish you could take the neutrino, but you know, do your best. And I want you to measure the top mass. Now, if you can't see this stuff in the middle, and all you see are B quarks or B jets, how do you know which B jet belongs to which top quark? Because whether it's a B quark or B anti-quark producing the jets look the same. There's no way to tell them apart. So now we have problems of combinatorics. Because, you know, you have this lepton that you see. Okay, you can see the charge of the lepton. It's pretty good, so you see the W. But then you see a B jet. And then you see another B jet, and then you go, does this B jet belong to this top, or does this B jet belong to this top? And then you have the missing neutrinos. So from something like this, it's actually pretty hard to measure the top mass. So I'll show you this cool example. I think it's pretty clever. Well, clever, it's you do the best that you can, huh? So first of all, when we look at TT bar events, the first thing we do is usually we take the E mu final state, meaning we want one W to decay to an electron, the other one to decay to a muon. Because the moment we take the EE or the mu mu final states, then you get very big background from Z. You're swamped by this stuff. So if you have an E and a mu in the final state, you're able to avoid the Z background. So you have several jets in this system. Yes?
Yeah, so experimentally, whether it's a particle and antiparticle or the opposite, that's, undistinguishable in the sense that
unless they're electrically charged. But
oh
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because you. Oh yeah. Right. Because the total is neutral, so that's why you can't distinguish.
Well, for a lepton, I can figure out which is which, right? Because the lepton. But for a B quark, this undergoes a fragmentation process.
Right.
It produces tons of particles that are collimated, and you don't go and some people do try where you look at every single particle in your jet and go, okay, that one has a charge of 1, that one has a charge of -1, that one has, and if you have like 20, 30, 100 of these in a jet, the chances are good that you'll get it wrong. just because you missed some. So basically, you can't tell to first order, let's say, you can't tell if it was a B quark or B anti-quark just by looking at the jet or even the composition of the jet. And then there are more jets produced in the final state as well, because of course you have, this is just the TT bar, but of course you have the leftovers of the proton also producing jets. So you have a lot of, you can potentially have a lot of jets in the final state. You have the two unobserved neutrinos, of course, that both contribute to the ET miss. You get only one ET miss corresponding to two neutrinos. Now you do have some constraints, in the sense that you know that lepton 1 plus neutrino 1 should equal the mass of the W, and lepton 2 plus neutrino 2 should equal the mass of the W, if you could measure those neutrinos. And you also know that that plus that plus that should be equal to the mass of the top. It's similar to that plus that plus that is equal to the mass of the top. So you have constraints. If only you knew, for example, which B quark was the right B quark and where you put your neutrinos. So what you do is you look at your ET miss. Now, ET miss, like I said, you only get one value for ET miss. It corresponds to two neutrinos. So what you do is you look at ET miss, and you look at the sum of what should be in a model, like with a simulation. You look at the sum of these two neutrinos, and you'd say, okay, let's pretend one neutrino is here and one neutrino is here. If I were to add them up, would that give me the ET miss that I measure in the experiment? Nope. Okay, let's go. Let's change now the eta to be different. So I scan my eta, and I change my eta, and I look at the ET of the two neutrinos in the simulation. I say, would that look like the ET miss that I measure? Nope. And so what you do is you basically scan the whole detector pretending you're putting two neutrinos, and then you look at the place where the two neutrinos best agree with what you measure in terms of ET miss. So it's a pretty clever way of doing it. So you do that the best that you can. Not always successful, because of course what the prediction says a neutrino energy should be in terms of ET miss. ET miss is never perfect, huh? You always have issues with the resolution, etc. So sometimes you have to add in a little bit of smearing for your objects. But basically, you scan parameter space and say, where would I need to put these two neutrinos to get the answer that is closest to these constraints? And that's how you decide on the pairing of the combinatorics.
Will the nature of neutrinos, Majorana, affect that measurement and that field?
In this particular case, I don't think so, but I don't think it would be sensitive enough to do that. That's a good question. We always assume that it's just a regular neutrino and not, I'd be delighted to find the other kind as well, but in here, this is just the standard neutrino. So about 20% of the time, this doesn't work, and then we just sort of throw it away and say, look, there's no solution, what can I say? So this example, I just wanted to show you, it gets complicated once you start having lots of jets because you get lots of combinatorics. And then we would go ahead and do our best to measure cross-section, which we like to measure as a function as many variables as possible. So here are a bunch of variables, maybe as in the mass of the TT bar, the rapidity of the TT bar, maybe the PT. And I tried to indicate to you what these various variables are sensitive to. So you want to try to measure as a function of mass and PT, because these variables would be quite sensitive to missing higher order corrections. So you would be able to see it quite well on a distribution. If you measured as a function of these variables here, then you could use this measurement to tell you something about PDFs. If you could measure it as a function of this variable here, for example, this one is a bit more sensitive to radiated gluons. So it's the same measurement that you're just slicing and dicing and showing in different ways. And from that, you extract different physics messages. So this is a summary of all the TT bar measurements as a function of root S. And here's our latest baby right here from This is the one from last year. Yes, indeed. 13.6 TeV, the latest one to join the family. You can see the nice clustering at 13 TeV. We took a lot of data there. And here is just the cross-section for all the different final states. So we talked about, you know, dileptons, final states, all jets, lepton plus jets. And so you can see then in something like this that the lepton plus jets gives you a quite precise value. You can see it here, for example. And it's funny, it's a little bit offset. Huh? It's not great. In any case, so you can see everything. And you can see underneath what you would get depending on which parton distribution function you used. So you can see a little bit the sensitivity there for that. Not only do we see two quarks, we can also do single top production. This is a lot harder to do. The cross sections are not as high as TT bar production. They are produced in basically three channels. So you have the T channel, the WT channel, and the S channel. Here is the predictions for each of these three channels as a function of energy. So here you have the Tevatron. And here you have what would be 14 TeV collisions at LHC. So again, you can see a factor here of 100 between the two. So you see even there, we're producing a lot of these simple single top quarks. One of the things you want to do with single top quark production is you want to probe this vertex here, the VTB vertex. All right? So this is the CKM VTB, which is basically one. And so you have access to that in each of these. Here it is again. And here it is again in each of these production channels. So you want to measure that. It was measured the Tevatron to precision of about 2 to 10%. Here are the results. This is measurement of VTB, effectively VTB, for the different mechanisms. You can see T channel here, WT, S channel, and all the channels. And what you get out of it, and like I said, in the CKM, it's basically one. It is also important to measure this, not just because it's important to measure it, but single top production is a background in Higgs and in SUBY searches. So you want to make sure that you understand that really well if you're looking for something that might have one of these as a background. Just a few more tiny measurements. This is the ratio of sigma T over sigma T bar. Just by doing valence quark arguments, you would expect that this ratio would be roughly 2. And you do see it's roughly 2, but it does evolve as a function of root S. You can see the different measurements. And then colored bands are the different PDFs superposed. So you can see that you have some sensitivity to PDFs. And here you have, the single top cross-section for the different channels, 1, 2, and 3, and at the different energies. So you can see these are great summary plots. So in fact, ATLAS and CMS get together. So when we publish separately our results, afterwards we just get together and say, okay, let's make a joint plot that shows all of our results. Or we'll even go one step further, and we do that, for example, with Higgs boson mass. We'll publish Higgs boson mass, they'll publish Higgs boson mass, and then we all get together and we say, okay, so let's correlate our systematics and let's do a real average between the two that fully takes into account all of the correlations. And there are correlations because we use the same accelerator, so anything related to the accelerator is correlated between the two experiments. Our experimental certainties are not so correlated, but of course any theory that you might use to extract things like backgrounds, Monte Carlo used for background, that would be correlated. So it's not a trivial exercise. It's not just like you take CMS mass of the Higgs and then ATLAS mass of the Higgs and you put them together and you get the answer. It's not quite like that. I wanted to show you this beautiful event. Just recently, we're very proud to announce that we saw not one, not two, not three, but four simultaneous top quarks in one event. So somebody asked the other day, how many jets can you get in a lot? Now, especially if you were to look for all hadronic top final states, which we don't do because it would be just horrible. But in this event here, and here is the beam is here, and here we have the collision in the center. So here you can see it in the transverse plane. This is an event that has 7 jets in it. 4 of them are tagged to be B tag jets, meaning that we looked at that jet very carefully, and we have reason to believe that that jet comes from a B quark. One of the W's decays leptonically to produce a muon. Here it is. And then you don't see it so well in this plane, but there's also another one. Here you can see better in this plane here, which is an electron in green. You can see the electron track, and then you can see the energy deposited in the calorimeter here. And then the dotted line gives you the missing ET. So this is 4 times 175 GeV, so it's a very, very heavy final state. And I'm going to show you a video. Do you want to see a video of 4 top quarks?
Yeah.
I can skip if you like, you know. Okay. All right, here we go. Boom! And out of that, you can actually see the jets because they are their blue cones. So that's the same event that I showed you in the static view just a second ago. This is the same one here, but this is the animation for it. And in blue is our best guess of the interesting leptons. You can see the missing transverse energy in the dotted line, and then you have all these blue jets, all of them. There's the missing ET. This is the missing ET.
And the yellow ones?
The yellow. So you have tracks that are in yellow. These are usually tracks that are not terribly interesting to us. They're not leptons. There are other tracks that form the jets. They are inside the jets. They come from quarks and gluons and things like that. So here is the plot that showed us that we see 4 top quarks in the final state. So here we have to get really fancy. We use a multivariate discriminant. So basically, we don't just use one variable to look for it, but we build a discriminant based on multiple variables that would be sensitive to it. You get a score out of that. And out of that, you can see the 4 top is the red. And then all the other ones are the backgrounds to this. These are the production mechanisms for producing 4 top quarks. You can see here you have some gluons, and then here you have your 4 top quarks. And a background, the Higgs is a background. not really a background, but the Higgs can contribute to the 4 top quark final state because you can have potentially TT bar from the Higgs. It's an off-shell Higgs, and the other 2 TT bar. Yeah. So the prediction for this is kind of interesting. We got lucky, yeah? We got lucky. It was predicted to be 12 femtobarns, so the next leading order cross-section prediction. We measured 22, so it's almost a factor of 2, but it has very large uncertainties at this point. It's basically 5 in statistics and 5 in systematics. So another way to turn it around is if you want to look at the significance above a hypothesis where this red doesn't exist, and all you're doing is measuring the other standard model processes, we would have expected to see something that was 4.3 sigma above that, if the standard model were correct, and we measured 6. And I'm sure the next time we measure it, you know, it'll be, when we add more data, then it'll go down. I mean the difference will start getting closer to the standard model. This is always launches like zillions of theory papers, right? It's like, oh my God, it's a factor 2 different between the standard model. Yeah, but it's just because there's not a lot of events, right? I mean, it was just the first announcement of it. Okay, I'm going to say a few words about Higgs, but I don't need to say much because my friend this morning said a lot of stuff about the Higgs. The most important thing is the standard model Higgs couples to mass. So we would like elephants rather than cute little mices here. Here he is. An event display. I mean, it's nothing super exciting about this. It's just a Higgs boson decaying it's a candidate, Higgs boson decaying to two W's, decaying to an E and a mu, and we believe this one went through the VBF production mode. One of the things that's really useful, not useful, but the Higgs is scalar. Well, all the other stuff like W's and Z's are not scalars. And so just how the Higgs decays to particles is enough to, well, not enough, but already gives us a big opportunity to be able to see that rather than W bosons. Meaning, just, you would expect, for example, from a diagram like this, the opening angle between the electron and the muon to be small just because of the spin zero nature of the Higgs boson here. So we can take advantage of this to be able to separate the Higgs boson from the standard model W and Z, and et cetera, type of production. It's, of course, central to the standard model. I don't think I need to say all of these things here. Maybe just four reminders, because I'm going to go through a lot of these in terms of the measurements. So no direct coupling to massless particles. You need to go through these triangle diagrams. You have gauge couplings, so to WZ. You have Yukawa couplings. This means coupling to fermions. And one hopes that we'll be able to measure at some point the self-coupling of the Higgs, so the Higgs to itself. We went a long way in 10 years. These are the plots announcing the discovery of the Higgs boson 10 years ago. There it is in the four lepton final states. I mean, honestly, if you only had this plot, would you go on record and saying, oh, I saw the Higgs boson? But, you know, you saw little X's here, and then this is the Higgs to gamma-gamma final state, and then you got to see a more significant, maybe, final state here, and then you look at the Higgs to WW, and then you see another excess just at the right spot. Just the fact that by looking at multiple final states, you saw a little bit here, you saw a little bit there, it was enough to sort of convince ourselves that we were seeing something. So in 10 years, we went from this to this. It's now part of the particle data book, with very precise information about its mass and where it comes from and all that kind of stuff. And I have to say that the bottom line is everything about it looks very standard model-ish. Here is a beautiful plot from CMS, which shows sort of the state-of-the-art kind of right now of the Higgs boson into the gamma-gamma final state. So the gamma-gamma final state, I mean, it's very, it has a lot of background, but it's a nice It's a nice continuous background on which sits a little peak. And so if you sort of subtract this background, then you get the nice peak appearing here. And then you have the mass of the Higgs from various decays, final states, using in run one. This was part of run two. This was not the final run two measurement of CMS. I suspect it will come out very soon. This is the best combination so far from CMS. And I have to say that everything about it looks incredibly standard model-ish. One of the things you want to check is its spin. Is it really like a spin zero? Like what's it? What are its quantum numbers? And I'm just showing you some simulation to just illustrate how some of these variables, this is cos theta star, and I put in the plot here so you can see what this angle represents. This cos theta star, or PT of the gamma gamma final state, what it would look like, and if you had lots of statistics, in terms of the shape of this distribution, if you had different spin hypotheses. So then you have the standard model one here, and then you have alternate hypotheses, for example, a spin twos. And you can see that the shape is sensitive to the spin hypothesis. So what we've done is we would build a test statistic, which was just a ratio of profile likelihoods for the Higgs model and for alternate hypotheses. And the way that we would do this is we would build a discriminant observable one for each of the channels that we would use it, for example, Higgs to gamma gamma, Higgs to four lepton. And then we would put it all, map it, kind of all that information together. And this is kind of the summary of what this test statistics would be for in dark blue, for example, is the standard model, plus or minus 3 sigma, and then all the alternate ones as well. And then the black line is what we actually measure. So really, it was a victory of run one that this Higgs boson hypothesis corresponding to the quantum numbers of Jp is equal to 0 plus is tested against several alternate spin and parity models. And well, we exclude basically all non-standard model hypotheses at 99.9% confidence level in favor of this. And that was the beginning of the end for non-standard model Higgs bosons. I want to show you a few measurements. So last year we celebrated 10 years of the discovery. And in a remarkable gesture of comradeship between ATLAS and CMS, we both decided that we would simultaneously publish an article which summarizes the state of the art of our understanding of the standard model. And it would be published on Higgs Day, which was the 10th anniversary of Higgs. So both ATLAS and CMS at the same time came out with a beautiful paper that basically, if you just want to read one paper, what is the experimental state of the knowledge of the Higgs boson, you just need to read that paper. And I'm going to show you a few of the results that came out of that. This morning, I don't need to go this, but I was discussed what are all the production mechanisms. Here they all are. They're all color-coded, and this color coding will carry through all the plots. Gluon-gluon fusion is the largest one. Vector boson fusion is about 7%, and the other ones are quite small. And at the bottom here are the decay mechanisms from WW, which is about 22%. ZZ is 3%. And then all the way down to here, the gamma-gamma, which was used for the discovery, I just want to point out here, you know, it's pretty nice. It has actually a tiny branching fraction of 0.2%, but it's quite a clean channel in the sense that, you know, it's quite different from the background underneath it. So even though the branching fraction is very small, you can actually see it quite well. And then the next ones that we would love to do is Higgs to mu mu, and that's even much smaller. All right, so again, in one fell swoop, production mechanism, decay mechanism, and you can see the various measurements for all of these with in gray wherever you can see them. So you have the I guess you can see a little bit here in gray is the standard model with its uncertainty. So some of them are measured to exquisite precision, particularly the gluon-gluon fusion. And then others still need a little bit of work, in particular the mu mu is yet to be actually detected. This was a plot that was shown this morning. Since the plot was shown, we have actually a first measurement of C, Higgs to C, C bar. Not great, I wouldn't call this a measurement, but it's an attempt at it. And I'll show you a plot related to that. It was mentioned this morning that these things are done in a kappa framework. So we're kappa, so there are two types of kappas that you will see in these plots. One is a kappa related to the production mechanism, so how different it is from the standard model. If it's you measure something that's exactly like standard model, the kappa would be one. And then you have the decay one, so it's just measuring how different the decay, so the branching fraction, is from the standard model prediction. So in a standard model, all these kappas should be one. And here are just three rough scenarios that you can do because you got an awful lot of these kappas. So you could say, well, what would it look like if, for example, I assume that you have a universal kappa between the W's and the Z's, and then you have one kappa for each of the fermions. Sorry, one kappa for all of the fermions, not each of the fermions. And then you put it in a two-dimensional plane. This is what is observed in terms of one and two standard deviation circles. And this is the standard model, so very standard model-ish. This is where you're a little bit more open, and then you just look at kappa, where you treat them all independently, and you look as a function of mass, because of course this is a hallmark of the Higgs boson. I wanted to show you this plot because it wasn't really mentioned this morning, so this is the new content. It's so in bright yellow. In the decay mechanisms, you can certainly have, for example, I don't know if I put it in here. Well, in the decay mechanisms, you can have, of course, neutrinos in the final state, right? So you, maybe something will go undetected. So, for example, if you have Zs in the final state. Or you can also even look at, what if the Higgs decayed to something invisible that is not the standard model particle? It's Higgs to something, something, non-standard model, but it's invisible, so we wouldn't have seen it. And we can also, doing these studies, we can put upper limits on, if it did decay to non-standard model invisible particles, what would be the biggest possible branching fraction that would be compatible with what we see? And the biggest one is to invisible or undetectable particles, basically 10%. So it's no way that you could have more than 10% of what you see decaying in that way. And because we have zillions of these production and decay mechanisms, one of the great things about collaboration and experiments is, before we actually went out and measured all of these, we went and had an agreement amongst ourselves. We said, okay, we're going to measure exactly this cross-section for this kinematic range. We'll measure this one, this one. So we actually had a whole menu of exactly what we wanted to do. And we had CMS on board, and we all agreed to measure the same thing so that we can compare exactly the same thing. So for example, we decided, all right, if we are looking at QQ to QQH, we will put a cut of less than, in very mass, is 350, and then we'll measure this. If we're looking at the TT bar final state, we'll use exactly the same binning so that Atlas and CMS would have something that's very comparable. Can you imagine if Atlas and CMS had decided to measure differently all these quantities? It'd be very hard to compare them. So these are the many cross sections that we measure. All right, a few words about our next upcoming challenges. So run two, the victory of run one was to see that it's very Higgsy. The victory of run two is we've pretty much seen the Higgs, all the Higgs production mechanisms. I think we've identified them all. We've seen them, observed them all. And we've observed all the decays to the third generation, even Higgs to tau tau, we've seen. The next generation, the next frontier, is to measure the couplings to the second generation. If you look over here, what I'm talking about is to measure with precision this one here and this one here, which is really not precisely measured. That's just a large uncertainty on that. So that's kind of the next frontier. This is a candidate, kind of a fun final state. The Z decays to two neutrinos, so you don't actually see the Z. And then the Higgs decays to a CC bar. So it's quite an empty event if you sort of think about it, because you have two jets coming, one for each of the Cs, and then a whole lot of missing energy. So this is a candidate. This is a plot where we try to build the invariant mass of sort of a C-jet final state, so basically of our of the jets that we observe in the final state. You'd say, hey, look, you can see 2,000 of them. Yeah, except if you look very carefully at the label, this is not Higgs to CC bar. This is the plot of a vector boson plus Z to CC bar. So actually, you've seen the Z again. And the one that you're looking for is kind of this little red stuff down here. And that little red stuff down here is just not significant. Huh? So really, at this point, this is what you would see in the standard model, this dotted line. This is what you see in the standard model if you took the standard model production cross-section for Higgs to CC bar, and you multiplied it by a factor of 26. So the real standard model signal would be 26 times smaller than that. But that's OK. I mean, we're approaching it. I mean, we're not just measuring how standard model-ish it is. We would like to see if it's not standard model, and if the way that we look for non-standard model is to hopefully look for deviations. Maybe we would get lucky. Maybe there's a new mechanism that produces Higgs to CC bar, which is enhanced compared to the standard model. But at the moment, we're about 26 times away the standard model branching fraction. So we need to go down a factor of 26 just to have the sensitivity to a standard model cross-section. The next big frontier apart from that is to measure Dihaeg's final state. So we want to look at the Higgs self-coupling. So this is a beautiful candidate event display of Dihaeg's. So one of the Higgs decays to BB bar. So that are the two red jets that you see here. One is a B and the other is a BB bar, as a B bar. And then you have also two photons. So the other Higgs decays to two photons in the final state. So here, up here, we have the production mechanisms for this. So two Higgs in the final state are not all the interesting Higgs we really want to look at, because not all two Higgs final state test the self-coupling of the Higgs. This one does. You can see this mechanism here, Feynman diagram here. You can see the Higgs self-coupling. So this is under gluon-gluon fusion. You can see here for vector-boson fusion, you have that one, but this one does not, although it does produce two Higgs in the final state. This one has a cross-section, a predicted cross-section of 31 inverse femtobarn. This one is 2 inverse femtobarn. So really, this is the mechanism that would dominate. But anyway, what the hey? We look for it anyway. This is the invariant mass of the two photons. So basically, you look for events like this one, and you build the two-photon final state, because the two-final state, it's a completely well-defined final state. So if you're lucky, two photons should build up to be the mass of the Higgs. So at least you would identify one of the Higgs. And then you just need to define the second one. This is what it would look like for the two-photon final state in a search for this mechanism. The Higgs boson's at 125, so that's right about here. Oof, we don't even have an event at 125. So we have a bunch of other grass around here. So really, at this point, this is just one of the categories. And we do this in four different categories. But we're not terribly sensitive to it. If you do a complete measurement, ends up that we're not that far away. Actually, we're about a factor of 4 to 5 away from being able to measure the standard model cross-section for this. So this is good news. This means that we might actually be able to get at this sooner than when we think. Just en passant to say, if you're going to look at something like that, you can also, in the same analysis, say, why not? Why don't I look, for example, search for maybe a heavy scalar decaying to two Higgses. So instead of having a Higgs decaying to two Higgses, you have a scalar decaying to two Higgses. Why not search for it? You don't find it, but you can set upper limits again for this kind of process if it were to exist. So it's kind of like you get these nice bonuses on some of these measurements. This is the prospects for the future. Now, 139 inverse femtobarn, that's basically our entire run 2 data sets. This is the data we took from 2015 to 2018. LHC is going to run until 2041. I will be long retired. Will any of you be retired in 2041? You'll be retired. You'll be retired. So there's stuff for you to do. And it's projected that if we stay on track, instead of having 140 inverse femtobarn, by the time we're done, we'll have 3,000 inverse femtobarn. So in fact, we've only taken about, 5% of all the data we'll ever expect to collect. So it's really just a tiny amount. So some clever person said, okay, well, let me take the measurements that we already do for run 2. So we took two final states, BB, tau tau, and BB gamma gamma. So that was the one I showed you before, the BB gamma gamma. And on top of that, take BB tau tau. So what would be the first thing you would do? What would it look like if I just keep adding statistics? So basically, you keep gaining root n, just counting on the statistics, and you did nothing else to the analysis. You are lazy, and all you do is just keep counting. This is the sensitivity here, so on the signal strength. So how many times away from the standard model you would be if all you did was counting events. That's the blue line. So by the end here, you're about 1.5 times away from the standard model, so you're awfully close. If I had a little help from my theoretical buddies, and let's say they were to half the theoretical uncertainty, that would get us awfully close to one, to basically the standard model prediction. If I worked on it, meaning that I, you know, instead of being lazy and just counting statistics, I actually, you know, improve my algorithms and try to just do the best that I can experimentally. This is where we could be. And if I were totally amazing and I could eliminate all systematic uncertainties and it's just statistics, this is where we would be. So the reality is, by the time we finish the LHC, HLLHC, we should be able to see this. And this is just Atlas. And this is just two final states. CMS will also do the same thing. And so all goes well. We should be able to see the Higgs self-couplings at the LHC before I die. So the question is, so what's next for the HLLHC? I have a little timeline here of HLHC. There were some dark days in called 2008. Do you know about 2008? Or is it better to not mention 2008? So we ran, it was so exciting. So we had, yay, CERN was so stupid. let's turn on the accelerator and bring the world in. We'll have all these reporters. Fortunately, that day worked really well. So we had reporters and the LHC turned on. It was like well orchestrated. And yay, the first collisions ever in the LHC. And basically within a few days, we had a big explosion of one of our magnets. And then the LHC had to shut down for a year. They had found actually a flaw in the magnets. So basically welding, for, of all things. It was a poor welding. And when they realized that one was, there was a poor welding, then they started to look at the other magnets and they went, ooh. And so for a year, basically, they had this big campaign where basically they just went and fixed all of these magnets. So it took us a year. Then we came back in 2009, and everything was tickety-boo. The first real higher energy run was in 2010. So this is run one. So we ran for 4 years, 3 years, I guess. Then we take a little break for 1 or 2 years. This is how we always run. We usually run 3 to 4 years. We take a break. This is run two. We took a break right during COVID. Now we're in run three. We'll take a little break. And then these are the later runs, run four and five. And so about 2040, I think the date these days is about 2041. Now, remember this plot, the amount of pile up, right? Interactions per bunch crossing. This is what we had for run one. This is what we have for run two. This is our current profile right now. When we take data next week, we'll be turning on again. We're in a little shutdown at the moment. Actually, the mu that we're running at these days is 60. And we've made tests. We can probably squeak by and get 65. But that's about as much as we can do at the moment. So it's here. And you might have seen in some of my slides, I talk about 13 TeV, 13.6, 14. 14 is the design center mass energy of the LHC. We have not been able to reach that yet. Again, technology sort of comes in the way. I mean, there are thousands of magnets in the LHC, so they produce them. And then they couldn't be installed yet, so they just put them in a parking lot. So some magnets just sort of hung out in the parking lot for a few years. And there was some deterioration. And you could associate it, apparently, to which company built which magnet. And it was always carefully hidden so that nobody knew exactly which was the company that was at fault. But apparently, you can see all these plots like, these magnets were built by company A. These magnets were built by company B. These magnets can't go to 14 dV. These ones can. We think we can, but what we need to do is we need to keep training the magnets to sort of go closer and closer to 14 dV. But what I wanted to show you, you might think going from 13 to 13.6 is not a big increase, and you'd go, meh. The increase is significant, and it gets more significant the heavier your final state is. So for example, between running at 13 dV and 13.6, you get a 20% increase in the four top production cross-section. That's a lot. That's 20% more for free. And should we see, I don't know, quantum black holes at 9.5 dV, the difference between a 13 dV machine and a 13.6 dV machine is a 250% increase. So for heavy final states, yeah, which is very nice. So the most recent run three, started on July 5th. And remember here, I showed you we had a little break just before that during COVID. And I'll tell you all about that in a second. And we did some significant improvements. The two improvements were related to our muon spectrometer, so improvements in the muon spectrometer, and also to increase the granularity with which we read out a calorimeter. So those were two major accomplishments. This is, I think, the first event we took. No, it's the first Z event that we saw of run three. It's a nice Z event. You can see the two electrons. This is us. Look how happy we are. On July 5th, everybody's going, yay! And we were still wearing masks last summer. We were good. Now, if you look back here somewhere, she's hiding somewhere back here. I'll show you our run coordinator. This is Sylvia. This is the second to last person I wanted to introduce you to. Sylvia is a postdoc, and she is the run coordinator. She is responsible for the running of the experiment, period. When the experiment turns on, it's her decision. How we operate, it's her decision. If it's not safe, then she tells us to turn off. And if you don't do your job properly, she will chase you down. So she's a good run coordinator, tough but fair, let's say. And she left you a nice happy message, how she loves this stuff. She doesn't do physics analysis. She doesn't go look for the Higgs boson or anything. Her career is the operation of experiments. All right, I want to talk to you. I have a few minutes. I'll be able to show you a video too. It's pretty cool.
Can I just ask,
yeah.
What sort of thing would not be safe that she would stay
home? So for example, the LHC would inject. And it looks like the beam conditions are not very good. You would not want to turn on your silicon detector if...
So she's monitoring the beam.
So that's one of the things that she does. And in fact, we have this thing called the handshake. So let's say in between fills of the beam, we know we're doing all kinds of tests and things like that. And, you know, we turn on different things. And then the LHC wants to inject and say, all right, we're ready. Are you ready? And then she'll go around the room and say, muon system, are you ready? Trigger, TDAC, whatever. And then literally there is a box back here with a key. Permission injection veto, click. So either she does this or the shift leader does that. So basically that's one of the roles. So it's to make sure that everything runs safely. And if something goes wrong in the middle of the night, because we run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the joke is, first beams every year always come on Easter Sunday. And if your detector doesn't work in the middle of the night and you're on call, hello, hello, wake up. You need to come here within the next 20 minutes to fix it. Okay, I want to show you a little bit about this one important component that we rebuilt. Well, actually, we built a new one. Starting in 20, actually we started building it much earlier than that, but basically targeting that little shutdown that we had in 2019, 2020, 2021. This is called the new small wheel because we had an old small wheel which we removed. It's actually a muon detection system that fits in the ends of our detector. You're going to see the picture in a second, but you know, Atlas, as you saw, kind of looks like a can of soup on its side, right? It's a cylindrical barrel. And then on either end, you have chambers as well. This is one of the chambers that goes there in the ends for muon identification. And you'll see its role. It's very important role. In fact, you can sort of see the diagram here. So imagine this is one quarter of the Atlas experiment, okay? So this is half of the barrel, the other half of the barrel, and then it goes all the way around here. So this is the interaction point. Then we have a series of chambers to identify the muons. You have the big wheel. Here's the big wheel, because it's 25 meters. And here's our cutesy little baby new small wheel here, because it's only 9 meters. But it plays a really important role. Imagine that didn't exist. And you have muons going through. Now, these muons kind of look all similar, right? But in one case, the muon really did come from the interaction point. In another case, this muon sort of scattered somewhere along here, and in fact, it's not really a good muon in the first place. And here, maybe this looks like a muon, but in fact, it doesn't come from the interaction point. So that gives us a very important extra point as a lever arm to be able to really see muons. And if we want to be able to see muons well, and also to see useful muons, this really reduces the rate of bad muons. So basically, by having this, we can eliminate this category and this category and really just take data coming from this category here. So I'm going to show you a movie in just a second here. But I just want to sort of give you maybe a sense of where things are. So in this picture here, this is one of the ends of the detector. And from here on, it's all of Atlas. Remember, I told you yesterday that everything in Atlas comes through two holes from the surface, and then everything gets lowered. You can see being lowered down to 100 meters. Who has seen that really, really terrible movie, Angels and Demons? The opening scene, you know, of... It's Atlas. They actually came to Atlas. The opening scenes of Angels and Demons is some Hollywood dude with a camera, lowering the camera down the access shaft, just as if you were lowering the new small wheel into the detector. Our control room is much cooler than the one that was in the movie. The one in the movie was quite disappointing. This is our control room.
No lab coats,
but we do have the very famous Atlas duck. So each of these islands that you see here is responsible for a different part of the detector. So for example, this island here is responsible for the inner tracker, so the technology of the inner tracker. This desk here is responsible for the calorimeters. The desk way at the front here is for safety. This is our safety person. And then you can't really see them because there are just too many people. But there's a desk for the trigger, there's a desk for muon, there's a desk for the depleter. And when we operate, not on first date, but when we operate normally, at night, for example, in the middle of the night, there are 8 people in the room at any given time in the control room. And during the day, there are more because you have experts coming in. All right, so the new small wheel. Wow, that was hard to do. It was our COVID baby because we started building it in various institutes around the world before COVID started, several years before COVID started. And we were on a, you know, we have to do it on time. We have to do, and then COVID happened. Now, strangely enough, you can't build a detector on Zoom. And literally, I mean, our universities were really good to us. I mean, if you remember at the beginning of COVID, there was so much uncertainty. We didn't know what was happening and things like that. And we had to build our own safety protocols, you know, how people would come in, what would they wear, how long would they stay, if are the windows are open, et cetera, in order to be able to continue building this thing during COVID. I was stuck in my apartment in France for a few months. In fact, France was very strict. I was not allowed to be more than 1 kilometer from my house and not outside for more than 1 hour a day, unless you're walking your dog. And there were, in some buildings, some dogs were being walked by everybody in the building, because that was an excuse to go outside. So the dog is going, yay. But anyway, we did manage to do it. So I wanted to show you just one little movie, because it's a beautiful movie. It shows the building. Actually, it shows not the building, but it shows the assembly at CERN and the installation in the experimental area. It's just a short video. So here it is in an experimental hall. You can see that they're installing one segment of this small wheel. You can see the size of the small wheel. You can see it's missing a module right there. And there it goes, being inserted. Okay, now we were taking it from the place where we assembled it to the experimental area on a day where I was afraid that thunder and lightning would strike us down. It was a horrible day. I was really afraid that we would get killed, but anyway. So we managed, this is the Atlas experimental area. There's behind there is the hole where you bring things underground. So we had covered it because of the rain. Here we go, we uncovered, there is our new small wheel. And now it's on the crane and it's gonna go down this hole right here. And everybody's there, I'm here at some point taking photos, I'm so excited. Here's the crane operator right here, the little guy here. So he operates from there, from like a, I mean like a PlayStation or something. And then he goes, and then he runs downstairs, and then he continues downstairs. And here it is coming down in front of the experiment. You can see behind there is the Atlas experiment. And it's going right in the end of the experiment. And over here is the big wheel. And this is the small wheel. Isn't it cute? It's adorable. So it is being inserted into the detector. This thing here is the magnet that provides the magnetic field from the muons. So there you go. It was fun. Oof, but we managed. Good, I still have a few minutes. I'm almost done. So you could ask very well the question, what is next for the LHC? Well, what's next is a whole lot more data taking. This is the high luminosity LHC era. Remember, we saw pileups of 50 or 60. CERN wants to give us pileups of up to 200. And this is a nice event, which just shows you, it's a simulation. It's the same event. It's a Z to mu mu. And it shows you what that event would look like if you had a pileup of 2, 50, or 140. So you can see how it obscures something that should be fairly clean just because the pileup is huge. And the way that you tackle this kind of problem is you want to increase as much as possible the granularity of your detector, the ability to tell all of these tracks apart. So what we're going to do is at the next long shutdown, which is going to start in a couple of years or 3 years, I guess, we will go and rip out the insides of our experiment, the tracking detector, and we're going to install a completely new one, much higher granularity with something like 5 billion channels in it, which is ridiculous. Here's another simulation of a TT bar event at mu's equal to 200. That's what it looks like. And just to guide the eye, they put a different color, the TT bar event that you're interested in. And all this other stuff is junk. You can see the interaction. So this is the various bunches as they interact. So you would have 200 of them somewhere. I want to remind you our four top quark event, which you thought was pretty busy. Mm-hmm. And earlier on, remember I showed you the Z mu mu to 25 vertices, which you thought, oh wow, isn't that ugly? All right, this is what it looks like at mu's equal to 200. So what we're gonna do is we are going to take out the very heart of our detector and replace it with an all silicon detector with incredible number of readout channels. It has many, many layers to it. So for example, if you're a particle going through the inner tracker, you'd go through 1, 2, 3, 4 layers of a pixel detector with very high granularity. And then you go through another 4 layers of strips. So it's a bit wider granularity, but still quite good. And the other thing that we hope to improve is at the moment our tracker only goes to pseudorapidity of 2.5. This one is going to go up to pseudorapidity of 4. So we're really going to increase the fiducial phase space of the detector. This is something we are working furiously on, even though we still have time. We're just horribly behind. Other big challenge, COVID. Has anybody tried to buy a car since COVID? You know, there's a huge microchip shortage. So we need a lot of microchips for this. So we're having difficulties just getting the raw material in order to do this, actually. Yeah.
Sir, what is the time scale that you hope to do this?
So we're going to run this year. We're going to run 2 more years. And then the shutdown starts. Now, and then we'll have a shutdown is 2 or 3 years, so we have a little bit of time that. But we're talking about we need to be finished in 3 to 4 years, basically, right? Here are a bunch of very happy people working, if you're interested in hardware. There's this, the inner detector is called the ITK. You can see the strips, you can see this person. Yay, it works! And these are people who take, they build modules, like a test module, and then they bring it to something called a test beam, and they say, okay, here's my module, I'm gonna put it there. And like I said the other day, you know, all right, I'm gonna run 100 GeV electrons through it, how does it react? Or you basically you dial the type of particles that go through. In this situation, another thing we really wanna test is how stable it is to radiation, because it's gonna see an awful lot of radiation with a mu equal to 200, so you want to know if it's robust to that. The last person I want to introduce to you is Petra. She just got elected. She is the project leader for ITK. All of this is her responsibility. It's a huge project. She is an applied physicist at CERN, so another person who doesn't look for the Higgs boson. She spends all her life working on instrumentation, so she builds detectors. And she's a super expert on silicon detectors. Congratulations, Petra, who took over from Claudia, who used to be our ITK project leader, another super person. Claudia was really good, too. All right, winding down. Look at that. I have 3 minutes. I'm perfectly on time. You might ask the question, what is there left for me to do? Me meaning you, not me. The best way that I can tell you this kind of stuff is maybe to recollect on the path of the LHC. The first thought about LHCs and experiments were in the mid-80s. Were you born in the mid-80s? I think I was in elementary school, high school, something like that. Took about 10 years to go from first thoughts to a formal approval saying, yep, go ahead, you can build an experiment. And then it took about another 10 years for Atlas to design, well, it already had started designing, but basically for the first bits of the detector to start appearing underground to fill the caverns. It was early 2000s. And the first high-energy collisions were in 2010. So it took about 25 years from first thoughts to first collisions. And it expects to run for about 30 years. 55 years from start to finish. So these experiments are multi-generational. So my generation is now thinking about what you guys are going to do, and then your generation will be planning what your children are going to do, or your children meaning your graduate students. Right? It's the only children that count in the world is your graduate students. But it was multi-generational, so you can see that, in fact, you have people who spend an entire professional career thinking about the LHC, planning the LHC, building the LHC, and oh, I have colleagues who retired like just before first collisions. And I'm gonna retire before the LHC is finished, the collision. So it really is a multi-generational. And so we are thinking very deeply about what is the next step after the LHC. So we already need to think now, even though the LHC is supposed to run until 2040. An obvious next step, so in a document here you can see all in Europe they've been building a strategy. An obvious next step is we know the Higgs boson exists and we can measure it pretty well at LHC, but you could build an E plus E minus collider that is specifically designed just to make Higgs bosons, just like the LEP used to specifically, it was designed basically to look at the Z boson. You could do this, it's like a Higgs factory, really designed. You could measure, you could not just hopefully see the self-coupling, but you could measure it really. And very optimistically, something like that could start appearing maybe 10 years after the LHC is over. And then the next step maybe after that is we could build a new LHC, maybe in the same tunnel. It would be quite a big tunnel, as you'll see in a second. But you could then build the next LHC, which would happen after this is done, where maybe you could go to 100 TeV. So 7 times the LHC, and there you could really study the nature of dark matter. So it would be really great if between now and then somebody would tell me what dark matter is, so I can be sure that I see it really well in this kind of facility. This is just a superposition of what it would look like. Remember when I showed you the video at the beginning, that you have the PS injecting to the SPS. This is the LHC. And this is a potential future collider of about 100 kilometers in diameter. And the advantages of this is, you know, one piggybacks on the next, piggybacks on the next. So I bet, and in this kind of scenario, the LHC would be the injector for this. So it's pretty exciting. And I think decisions need to be made fairly soon if you want to start going in the direction like that. Fairly soon meaning, you know, in the next few years. So you can start building and be ready. This is.
I spoke with, you probably know, John Butterworth.
Yeah, yeah.
Last week, and he was saying that a big step has been taken here. That approval has now been received by all the given by all the countries to actually, you know, have something.
To have something, yes.
So there is a route.
There is a route. Very expensive, so they probably need to bring in more friends than what they have now to be able to pull this off. So it's already great that if there's support coming from the original partners, let's say, but I think they would need a lot more partners to be able to really.
I think you meant the various countries that have this
model. France and Switzerland. Yes, and sure, indeed. They have I mean, it's underground, so it doesn't take the land out of anybody. Mostly underground, because you'll need to have some access points to go to whichever experiments you end up putting on the FCC. But yeah, they have the approval of the states to be able to build this kind of facility underground, indeed. This was one of the first photos we took after COVID, when we started getting together. So this is only a small fraction of Atlas. It's only maybe 300 of my best friends. Here I am, right there. Couldn't you tell? It was great. We were able to all get together again. This is last summer, basically. All right, that's it. I've come to the end.